Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas by The Independent Institute. Today we'll pick up with part two of our discussion with Michael Schellenberger, best-selling author and investigative journalist. You know, I want to ask you something about the censorship and, you know, this idea, this concept of this sort of government involvement in censorship, which I don't doubt. In fact, I know it's true in everything that we saw in the Twitter files, but also elsewhere, no question. But, you know, in my experience, certainly in the Trump White House in 2020, the social media companies were on their own censoring. They decided to censor. They had people. I was in the room once or twice when we were talking to the social media companies, telling me they were censoring, they were pulling down President Trump's tweet, his words, or I was the advisor to the president on the pandemic for 3.5 months, and they took down my tweet, they took down my YouTube interviews. You'd think the people in a free society should hear what the president was saying. You should think the people in a free society should be able to hear what the advisor to the president was saying. They weren't told to do that by the government because the government at the highest level was President Trump. So that to me, I don't want to allow the excuse of the Zuckerbergs of the world, of the Jack Dorseys of the world, of the social media companies, the excuse that, oh, they were intimidated by the government, which I know, I believe did happen under the Biden administration. I understand all the stuff about in the post-vaccine era. I think they did it on their own. And I think this is also something that's very tricky legally, right? These are private companies. Are they allowed to do that? But they're the public square. And I wonder what you think about that when the private companies themselves just say, okay, we're blocking this person. We're using our rights as a private company to do what we want.
Well, I think you're underestimating what the government was doing. You say the Trump administration, the White House was the most senior part of the government, but the Trump administration did not control the cybersecurity and information security agency of the Department of Homeland Security.
No, that I understand.
Yeah.
I do understand that. But I still think there was a political activism going on, is my point.
Not surprising. I mean, in other words, Twitter was 99% of employee donations were going to Democrats. They were super woke. We knew
right.
that they were shadow banning. We confirmed that. The surprise is that the FBI with the Aspen Institute ran a disinformation operation in the summer of 2020 claiming that the Russians were planning a disinformation effort relating to Hunter Biden and Burisma. And then they had workshops for the reporters and the social media companies to brainwash them, they say pre-bunking,
mm-hmm.
so that, and this, you have to remember, the FBI had Hunter Biden's laptop in December of February
yes.
of 2019. They were spying on Rudy Giuliani as he was trying to get journalists to cover the laptop. So here
right.
the FBI is, they're listening to Giuliani. They're saying, oh, he's trying to get somebody to cover this. We have to go tell Zuckerberg that it's going to be Russian disinformation and they should censor it. We have to go get Aspen Institute to go and do multiple workshops, brainwashing journalists not to cover the story. FBI then has, what I know is the general counsel of the FBI, arguably the second most person in the organization, leaves to become deputy general counsel at Twitter in the summer of 2020. At which point he is right there, like he's quiet for a lot of stuff. But when it comes to should we censor the Hunter Biden laptop, the top woke censor at Twitter, his name is Joel Roth. He and his team look at the New York Post story and they say it doesn't violate our terms of service. We should not censor this. It does not violate our terms of service. The former FBI general counsel turns the whole FBI around and convinces them to censor the laptop. His name is Jim Baker.
Right.
And, you know, Joel Roth also says he had been programmed as well before by the Aspen Institute. And he even says in an interview with Kara Swisher, he says, all of this all of these warnings, you know, of a hack and leak. That's what they call it, a hack and leak operation. And I was he was basically saying he was trained to think of this. But even after having all that training, he still said we should not censor this. And it was a former FBI person. Now, you have to remember, in the intelligence community, when you talk to people in the intelligence community and you say a former CIA person, they go, no. They go, no. You don't understand how it works. You don't leave the intelligence community. That's what they say to you.
Right.
We have CIA people on video saying, we know if we get them early, they're ours for life. I mean, there's an omerta kind of culture in CIA and FBI, particularly in the parts of it that have been corrupted by partisanship. So I think that, and then that doesn't even account for this mass censorship operation run out of Stanford University at the behest of the Department of Homeland Security on election information in 2020 and then COVID
right.
2021.
No, that I agree. Yeah, I mean, there's no question. And I sort of think it points to the real problem, and I think it's more frightening than saying it's the government, and that is it's the intelligence community. I know it's multifactorial. I know it's multi-pronged. I know it's what people want to call the deep state. I mean, there's no question that the agencies have far more control than people even understand, because they navigate the terrain and have been there for years and years. They outlive any administration. It's nothing. These people are just transient visitors when they're president of the United States. And,
right.
and the, you know, without even using the term deep state, the people in the agencies, one of the things that I'm pushing for are term limits for people in the agencies. We have problems with these career bureaucrats who accrue power and use it with perverse motives that are, you know, you can't have something like that. This is obvious. But I'm very concerned about the intelligence community, because this gets into sort of movie level, concern. I mean, I'm not sure, we all grew up, or at least, you know, I'm older than you, with the questions about the JFK assassination, with, you know, all kinds of issues have been questioning where the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, all this kind of stuff, Sam Giancana and the mafia sort of stories. I grew up in Chicago. That's why I can identify with that. But, I don't know what the solution is when it's the intelligence organizations who are really operating, sort of on their own. I mean, that's just a reality. I don't know what we think about that. It's one thing to have laws about free speech. It's another thing to discover overt government involvement, like Biden administration talking to Twitter or whatever. I'm just concerned. I don't know what a solution would be when it's really like out of a spy movie here, some of the things that you're discovering.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's not just a single thing. I mean, look, they didn't release all the JFK files. You know what I mean?
Right. Like,
there's a huge amount of secrecy. There's abuses of power. I mean, the solution is, we know what the solution is because we did it in 1975. It's the Church Committee hearing. It's a new head of the CIA, William Colby, comes in. He goes around and says, tell me all the dirty secrets. He creates a document called the Family Jewels, which is all the worst things the CIA did. By the way, it was released except for the top one, which many people actually... And I think I might agree, if you're speculating, what is the one missing from all the things listed? Because they talk about the mafia. I mean, look, FBI was just, when you read the histories of the FBI, it was just criminal. I mean, they just were working with criminal gangs like the whole time.
It's organized crime.
There's no conspiracy theory about it. I mean, that was what the FBI, that's how they were doing it. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. Yeah, you kind of get to, you got a clean house. I mean, look, I think that Epstein is a sex blackmail operation. And most reporters who have covered Jeffrey Epstein agree that it was a sex blackmail operation. The director of the CIA went to Epstein's house. I mean, it's crazy. Like, you're like, what was he doing there? This is not a conspiracy theory. This is Wall Street Journal reported it based on his journals. So, you know, you kind of go, there's just a lot of, it's a rat's nest.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to have, what Jim Jordan did with his weaponization committee was the, well, I think the most important thing that's happened since the Church Committee hearing. The only problem with it is that the Democrats were fighting him the whole time. When you had the Church Committee hearing because of Watergate, and Watergate had so completely discredited Nixon, that the Republicans went along with revealing all the dirty secrets of the CIA and the FBI and all the bad stuff. I mean, not all of them. They certainly kept a bunch of them, but they did, you know, and Colby came in, they clean house. So, you know, and then we had another one after 9/11, which then kind of, I mean, I'm actually looking at IC reform, but I mean, certainly Trump, if he's elected, has said, you know, I mean, you see there's, the New York Times is already attacking your former colleague, Kash Patel, who, you know, they're just viciously going after him. And I think that it's just, they're worried that he'll become the head of the CIA and clean house, you know, and he can fire people or move people around or do all sorts of stuff. It won't, I mean, look, it's like, to some extent, you're a big country like the United States, you're a big old, you've got a lot of buildup, but we should be able to get a lot more control over the intelligence community than we have now. And I think
we need disruptors. Because it's really taking on a system that is very, very deep and entrenched. And I think we all know that, you know, the tentacles of the sort of what I call corruption, for lack of a better word, are very, very complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think what has struck me, wrap up with a couple of small questions, really, but they're big issues. Like, why is it controversial to expose these problems? I can't get over how so many people, I'm not talking about the entrenched special interest type of people. I'm not talking about the higher ups, their reaction. Of course, they have a lot at stake that to lose. Regular people, I'm not sure most people agree that we should, that people like you that are exposing these kinds of nefarious, very destructive, harmful things. That's not supported by a lot of people. Did you ever think about that? Like, why is that? Why would regular people, is it that they're afraid to hear the truth, or they're threatened by the sort of contrary information to what they've always believed in? Or what is going on with people who don't want to see the real truth about what's going on?
Well, it's even worse than that. You see, among on Gallup or maybe Pew, the percentage of Democrats who want the government to censor social media platforms went from 40% to 70% between 2018 and 2023. I know exactly why that is, because everybody in my family has Trump derangement syndrome and is voting for Kamala Harris. They think, A, Trump will turn the United States into a dictatorship. They really believe that. And B, that the only reason that Trump is elected is because of misinformation online. Therefore, to save democracy, we have to have censorship.
Now, so propaganda works, basically.
I mean 5 years of just relentless. I have to say, it's like programming, because you know, it's like there's like a script. Now, you can kind of interrupt it. I figured out three ways to do that. You know, one of them, as I say, when you think about past movements for things that you care about, like democracy, human rights, if I'm talking to progressives, women's rights, gay rights, civil rights, do you think censorship or free speech advanced those movements more? And they have to stop and they go, okay, I guess probably free speech. And then you can say, if you gave the government to censor misinformation and hate speech online, could you imagine a situation where somebody in the government might abuse that power and censor things for political reasons? Okay, I see what you're getting at. You slow them down a little bit. And then the third one is, like, all else being equal, do you think that the good causes that you, the progress and things that you care about, is that going to be benefiting more from censorship or from free speech? I find those three questions, you know, it's the Daniel Kahneman fast thinking, slow thinking. Fast thinking, you know, should we fight misinformation online? Yes, we should. Of course, we should fight. Should we fight hate speech online? People don't know what they're being sucked into. It's a deliberate. I mean, I'm sure it's a deliberate trick. You get everybody alarmed about misinformation, and the need to fight misinformation, and then
in fact,
seems like
yeah, That's the basis of using these words, misinformation, disinformation. I mean, we didn't need these new words. I mean, there's right. wrong information and there's lying. I mean, that's sort of...
And there's disagreements.
Right. I mean, they're weaponizing these words with new vocabulary. Yeah. It's really right out of also sort of 1984. I mean, there's so many parallels. It's that in and of itself is frightening. The other thing I think that I wanted to bring up as a legacy, and that's not over, this censorship, this propaganda, this sort of effort to stop the free exchange of ideas that is civil. And necessary in a cohesive free society that is so diverse. The absence of that has caused a tremendous amount of hatred in this country. I feel like there's a hateful division. It's not just a division. It's a hateful division.
Yeah.
And I'm very concerned because they have not just undermined trust in institutions, but they've undermined trust in your fellow citizens. You know, with this, one example is, it's a repeated pandemic of the unvaccinated. And, people were calling their neighbors during the pandemic because there was more than four people in their house. It reminds me of Nazi Germany, frankly, and not that I am a scholar of Nazi Germany. I'm not. I'm very worried if we're going to recover, because right now, and again, like people, it's easy to say it's due to Trump derangement syndrome, which I think is a real entity. I'm worried, though, that, they did attack Romney. They did attack George W. Bush. They did be making up stuff. They would attack DeSantis, I'm confident, if he was the nominee. And I wonder if this hate can continue. Do you see any signs that there's any kind of lessening of that? And if not, what do we do about that?
I don't know. If there's a solution to it, I don't know what it is. I mean, totalitarian movements do end. Unfortunately, they end in ugly ways. I mean, Reagan's genius, which I did not appreciate when I was a radical leftist in the 80s, was to say this is evil. That the Soviet system is evil. And I'm not a big good versus evil guy. Like, in general, I just think people have psychopathologies or they're creating a new religion. But like the Soviet communist system was totalitarian in that sense. It really was evil. It was important to say that. There's another thinker that we're very interested in. He's actually a Polish psychologist who lived under Nazism and under communism and wrote a whole book about the psychology of totalitarianism. And what he said, his name is Andrew Lobachevsky. He says, you can't just condemn it. You also have to describe it psychologically. Because his argument was that totalitarianism is the process of psychopaths and narcissists taking power. So you have to describe the pathological nature of it. Mm-hmm. And so these questions, when I do those questions, I'm always sort of like, it's like you're trying to, and the programming, you're trying to disrupt the programming. Could you see how if you did that, you could have these problems? Could you see that in a way? Asking people to slow down. I mean, look, I think ultimately you need a disruptor or something. You need a change of government. I mean, like,
you really do need to change.
You need a political reaction.
Yeah, there will be a reaction one way or the other. It could be very, very ugly, as you say. I mean, I've been reading, trying to grapple with what's happening these days. I've been reading or rereading things like Hannah Arendt and C.S. Lewis and even a little Kafka. Some of these things, that Dante's Inferno, I went down that path. And when you look at Arendt, I mean, one thing that sticks with me about Hannah Arendt was when she said at the Eichmann in Jerusalem sort of trial, her review of it was, we see a confusion about basic elements of morality. And I think that is really, where we are. We do have a very, very shocking, to me, confusion about what seems so easy to identify as immoral or unethical. And that confusion, that can't continue. or we're really, you know, we're going to have serious problems. And I don't think any, I think most people are good people. And when you said you don't like good or evil, yeah, but I agree sort of, but I do think, you know, I do think most people are good, fundamentally good. I have to believe that. I think we probably all do. But they're not aware of what's happening. I actually believe, and they're impacted by the propaganda, and because, you know, propaganda works, and we've seen it in various regimes. You know, what the most frightening quote I can remember is Joseph Goebbels, who said, you know, if you repeat a lie enough, it becomes the truth. But what was frightening about what he continued with is, and you believe it yourself to be true.
Right.
I mean, that is really the ultimate impact of it. And I think we need to be sort of shocked out of that, many people. So I don't know. I'm sort of still slightly retaining a fragment of optimism about that we can fix this.
Yeah, I mean, the optimism for me, the optimism is the First Amendment and free speech. Because if you have the First Amendment and free speech, then you can actually disrupt totalitarianism in some important ways. If you don't have that, it becomes very hard to do. You know, that's why I'm so fanatical about free speech. You know, it's essential. Like, you can't have liberal democracy.
There's nothing without that. And in fact, that's what's worrisome about the UK with their movement of censorship, making it criminal. Brazil, I mean, I'm just shocked at what's going on in what I thought were free countries.
Yeah, I mean, and the Arendt, you know, Arendt's story about totalitarianism was also the destruction of the private individual. And so you're not allowed to have a domain of life separate from politics. The book I was mentioning before that defined totalitarianism around the hunting of heretics and apostates is a similar sort of thing. In other words, you can't allow anybody in the society to have these different beliefs. That actually the existence of people with different beliefs than the official state woke ideology is a threat, and they start to persecute them. And then the mob gets involved in it, you know, and they kind of go, oh, you know, these, you know, and it's religious, you know, there's sort of satanic. It's like a satanic panic, except for it's MAGA panic. It's ultra MAGA panic.
Yeah, I'm worried about the lack of education. You know, we could talk forever. I'll wrap this up. But you know, it brings to mind, you know, Robert Nozick, who basically said that the real function of society was simply to ensure the individual freedom, the individual's rights. And I feel like we have a generation or more that has been really is simply uneducated about these very basic fundamental principles that the country was really founded on, more or less. And I think we have to address that too. There's short-term solutions, but we need to address this sort of intermediate and longer-term things like what's going on our university campuses, et cetera, because. We need to have, and I'm doing this on my own too with the Global Liberty Institute, we need to foster young people who believe in freedom, because they're not alone. And actually the moral high ground is the belief in freedom. The moral high ground is not to be ceded to the side that wants to censor. And yet as sort of that side of censorship and restricting freedom has somehow claimed a moral high ground in a shocking way, really, to me. So we have our work cut out for us, but continue with what you're doing. You're a really very important person these days, and I congratulate you on your work.
Appreciate it.
You got to keep it up. We need people that fight for freedom, because honestly, freedom is good, and lack of freedom is evil, in my way of thinking. But we have to make the case, and we have to keep fighting. So we'll see what happens, regardless of any kind of election outcome. The problems are going to be there, and we don't give up, no matter what. So Michael, really great pleasure meeting you. Great pleasure talking with you, and I hope I can have you back again.
It was great being with you, Scott.
Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Michael Schellenberger, watch his expert commentary in the news, follow his Substack called Public, and on Twitter, follow him at SchellenbergerMD. And don't forget to subscribe to this show on YouTube, as well as on Spotify, Apple, Google, anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now. And I'll see you next time.